Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast, everybody. I'm super excited to bring another student from Wayne State University who worked with Tess Bazinski, who was on my show just a little bit ago, and she talked to us about mushrooms and some exciting things there. And so she connected me with her friend Adam Pruitt, who's a biology student there, and he's going to talk to us more today and share his story. So welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I'd love to share everybody's story, and I've learned so much. I know everybody's learning from each other, so we're going to learn from you today, too. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'll be turning 25 this month. I'm a biology student at Wayne State. I've been focusing my studies mainly on plants as much as possible. I did work in a plant molecular evolution lab for over a year, and there was a greenhouse there, so I got it was pretty interesting to get to work with a botanist and really understand, what goes into botanical research. So that informs my gardening philosophy now a little bit. I've been gardening since I can remember.
All right. Well, so my next question is to tell us about your first gardening experience. So do you want to tell us about that? Like, how old were you? Who were you with? What'd you grow?
So my dad was in the military and my mom worked a full-time job. And so I spent a lot of time with my grandparents who had a large garden. And basically my earliest memories are of being in a garden. So just being outside in their backyard and just, being a little kid in the dirt, being in the mud, digging holes, and, just being around the plants and everything. So I pretty much grew up in a garden. I think that has kind of stuck with me because when I think back to my childhood, that's some of my best memories are probably in a garden. So
nice. I like definitely. That. Now, did you grow up in Detroit from Michigan, or how'd you end up there? Is this where you're from?
So, Dearborn. I'm from Dearborn, which is right outside of Detroit. It's suburban. So, nobody has a lot of land in the Detroit metro area, but, big enough backyard to have a nice sized garden. I'm not sure. My grandparents probably had about a half acre total, and the garden might have been like a quarter acre. So it wasn't huge, but it wasn't small. It's a pretty decent, you can grow a lot of things in a quarter acre, and we did. So
you can grow a lot of things in a quarter acre.
Yes.
So what do you remember growing? Do you remember growing like carrots or anything, vegetables or flowers or anything that you really can
my
remember?
Grandpa prided himself on growing the biggest tomatoes. Some real heirloom tomatoes. He was meticulous about growing the tomatoes, and he always, he was into the organic compost, and he didn't spray any fertilizers or any pesticide or anything like that. So he liked to smoke his pipe and sit in the garden. So I think he just spent a lot of time out there and was eating them. But yeah, tomatoes, definitely the one thing that I remember kind of dominating the garden, being in the center. And it was always a competition amongst my family who had the biggest tomatoes that year. So it was kind of fun.
I like that. All right. Do you want to tell us what organic gardening or friendly gardening means to you then?
So, yeah, I kind of thought about that, and one of my good friends works in horticulture at a greenhouse, and we kind of have this argument about what does it mean to be organic, and we had this argument in the laboratory, too, and so it got kind of interesting, but I mean, to me, organic gardening is just kind of, when you walk into a garden, it's just, it's kind of a measure. In my experience, I should say, walking into a garden where someone is using synthetic chemicals versus organic chemicals, I don't know. I seem to notice that I would say there's a different level of coherence in the garden. If you're spraying a lot of synthetic chemicals, pesticides, or, you know, and fertilizer, watering with, certain Miracle-Gro, or there's like Jack Classic people use around here, I know. And you can just kind of tell, you know, looking at the soil and looking at the plants, that there's a lack of, I like to say coherence. I realize it's kind of an abstract term, but it seems like everything is harmonious and coherent, and everything kind of grows together and fits together. And there's just the overall sense of health and harmony in a garden or a small farm or a greenhouse even. And so to me, organic is really just a term that is a measure of how harmonious and how coherent your ecosystem is, whether it be a garden or a farm or a forest, whatever it is. So I think, you know, organic is definitely, there's a spectrum, I would say. Like you talk to certain people and they would, in the greenhouse world that I know, they would say like even neem oil is not organic really, because it's a concentrated extract. They would say that's not organic. So, but a lot of people would say that's just fine. That's totally organic. So to me, it's really just about intention and, realizing the consequences of what you're doing. Is it acceptable to you? Do you feel comfortable and safe with it? I mean, so organic is just, you know, would you feed your kids that? that's kind of where I look at it from, that perspective.
I like that. That makes sense to you. That's a good one. That's a good way to put it. Would you feed your kids that? Excellent. And one of the biggest things I've learned from doing the show is, do you really want to let your toddler crawl on that lawn or let your pet run on that lawn that has those chemicals? You know, you're weeding right. feed, making sure you're not having dandelions. I mean, really, because it sounds like those, that's like one of the biggest toxic things that's hurting, because pets and toddlers are so tiny and they're so close to the mm-hmm. ground, they're ingesting a lot more of it. And that it's different right. for adults. So,
right. And they have weaker immune systems. They're yeah. more susceptible. So, mm-hmm. And that's what, I mean, that's kind of what I mean about the coherence though. For, when you take the human aspect away, it doesn't make so much sense. But when you put a toddler there, you know, now is it safe? Is it acceptable? I think that's how, you know, I kind of measure if the whole ecosystem is coherent, because there's, you're not using something synthetic that's kind of knocking out that vital quality and the poison, essentially making it incoherent. I would say, I don't know how,
I think that's a great way to put it.
Sense, but, mm-hmm. but that's where I'm coming from. So
no, I think that's a great way to describe it and make people like make that personal connection. So then who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques? Was it your grandpa back then, or like what you've learned at school?
Yeah, it
or?
Have to be. It would definitely be my grandparents. I mean, and my friend, I should say, like, my brother works in a greenhouse. And my good friends are in the study horticulture at MSU. And so I kind of see the horticulture world and just how inorganic it is.
Oh, really?
In a lot
it
of
is?
Ways. I would say so. I mean, there's a lot of in spring. Spraying pesticide is very common. You don't see, like, it's pretty controversial it's very expensive for a greenhouse to not do that, because they take a huge risk in not spraying preventatively, not spraying pesticides preventatively, and not and the problem with using organic methods in a production world is that fertilizers, organic-based fertilizers, are typically not water-soluble. So if you have irrigation, you know, if you're growing thousands of plants, you need to irrigate them efficiently, and you're not able to irrigate really, because the organic fertilizers are typically not water soluble, so they'll clog your irrigation, and that just, you know, that really screws up production. So, but yeah, my grandparents, I mean, it more than you know, obviously in a small garden, you're not worried about production, so not necessary. You know, you're not worried about high yield or getting maximum yields. So, yeah, my grandparents just sitting around, you know, just being in the garden, being present in the garden, and spending a lot of time up close to the plants, I think, you know, kind of informs you intuitively into what is organic. And, you know, you're not going to spray glyphosate or Roundup and then go and, you know, be touching up against your plants, or at least you shouldn't, hopefully. So, yeah, just being in my grandparents' garden, you know, taking the lawn clippings, composting them. You know, we had a lot of worms in the garden, and we would throw the worms into the compost bin. So, I think just little things like that, just kind of seeing how a well connected ecosystem, how healthy it is, and how much life there is just kind of bursting out of it. Has taught me how to grow organically, or shown me what an organic garden really looks like. So.
Perfect. I like that. So are you going to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Well, I grew a lot of things this year. So if you remember talking to Tess, I manage the community garden at Wayne State. So grew quite a bit of things there. I also have my garden at home. So grew a lot. And I know I learned a lot because they were in different spots. And the garden at school, unfortunately, is pretty shaded. Oh. So it's not exactly ideal for growing, say, tomatoes. Mm-hmm. You don't get that full sun. I mean, the greens grew really well. Our greens, bok choy in particular. Well, we sell everything at the market, so I should say that kind of informs me on how well we're doing, because I can kind of see at the end of the day, how much did we sell? How many people really thought this looked good or didn't sell well? And, you know, even then you can kind of see in the garden how well everything did over the course of the season. You can look back at how our sales were and gauge it that way. But basically our greens did amazing. And, you know, super simple to grow greens. You just stay on top of the bolting and try to do some vertical things to kind of shade the greens so that, you know, so in the heat of the summer they weren't getting full sun. But, at home, my tomatoes did really well because I made sure I grow them in large pots. I grow them in 30-gallon pots, and I make sure I rotate them every day, and they're getting really, really well covered by the sun. And I always make sure to water and feed them when they're looking before they look hungry. And so I love my tomato plants at home, but. Yeah, ghost peppers grew. It was the first time I actually grew ghost peppers.
What
myself.
Are ghost peppers?
Really, really, really hot peppers.
Oh. Like they
might
wanna,
have to.
They want to kill you and turn you into a ghost? Sorry.
If you bite into one, you will probably be regretting it for a couple hours.
So. Oh, my goodness.
It's not for the timid, but it's good if you're like cooking a stew. You only need like a half a pepper in like a 10-gallon pot or something of stew or something like that. So a little bit goes a really, really long way, depending on the exact variety of ghost peppers. Mm-hmm. The one that we grew, and I'm not, you know, I haven't checked this fact, but what I was told was it's the Butte Jaloca, it's called, and it's the second hottest legal. So this is what I'm curious. I kind of want to look it up. If certain species of ghost peppers are apparently illegal because they're so hot, at least to sell without a disclaimer. So, because they can induce heart attacks, apparently. So,
wow.
So those are very hot. But they grew amazingly this year. And I think it was just because a lot of people, we had a really slow start to our summer. It was really wet and cold. And so it seemed that the ghost peppers, at least where I planted them, they got a good amount of sun and they were able to kind of take root well despite those conditions, so that when the summer kicked into full swing, they were just ready to go. Compared to everything else in the garden, I should say, they looked a lot better.
Oh, okay.
So they kept producing. Once they started the fruit, they just kept producing tons and tons of peppers. And it's really cool because I don't think a lot of people grow them, so it's kind of like a little neat novel thing to have. That if you want to dare someone who's on your nerves, you can give them a seed of the ghost pepper or something. So, but yeah, if you're gonna grow ghost peppers or eat ghost peppers, definitely do a little bit of research. I feel like I have to add that disclaimer. So. Do not tread lightly. They're not for the timid. So, but I like
hang
really
out with that. You want to dare? All right, don't answer.
Yeah, that's I don't crazy. Know if I feel. I want to name names. But.
Okay. Other things I'm curious about are, so how much food are you growing in the community garden at school that you're selling stuff at the farmer's market? And she told me like some incredible stat, like your farmer's market is like all day from like 11 to 4 or something, did she say? Or
yeah, it's from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. It fluctuates how many vendors show up, but it's from, we got like 8 to 15 different vendors. It's a pretty good size market relatively.
Yeah,
Detroit,
it must be.
I don't know if people know. I feel like I should talk a little bit about Detroit and why it's really unique.
Sure.
We in Detroit, our laws permit agriculture within a metropolitan area, which as far as I know is not legal anywhere else. So you don't have to go get a permit to have a farm in Detroit. You can just go ahead and start a farm. So that's unique as far as I know. And at least if that is allowed other places, in Detroit, people are doing it. So there's a really large movement for urban agriculture and urban gardening and farming. Everywhere you go, you'll see just gardens in the most random places, greenhouses, rooftop greenhouses and gardens. So, you know, I know a lot of people think of Detroit probably and just think of industrial wasteland, but it's really cool to see that contrast between essentially industrial ruins and gardens. And I mean, it's ghettos and gardens everywhere you go outside of Detroit. It's, you know, you have a five square mile downtown kind of radius, and then about a 20 mile belt surrounding that is essentially, it's not vacant, but is sparsely populated, and there is a ton of empty land and people are farming it. And it's really cool to see just, you know, how many people are really getting involved into the social aspect of eating local food and food justice. I mean, we have a lot of homeless people, and our homeless people have the opportunity to eat pretty well, at least during the growth season. So, I mean, Detroit's pretty spectacular from that aspect. And that's kind of what got me engaged in all this, is I just wanted to network with people who are growing food. Cause to me personally, I want to grow my own food. I think it's, to me, it's intuitive. It's a natural thing that I feel like I kind of have to do. Like, it just feels like a human need that I should have to, I should grow my own food. I should cultivate my own food and be connected to it. And then logically, it doesn't really make sense to import it from distant places. But yeah, Detroit is just really amazing. All the urban gardening and the markets, and there's at least a dozen markets within the city limits. So there's an opportunity to create a niche for anyone who there's a garden industry, there's a green industry movement happening, and a lot of people are working hard to make it something that stays. And you know, I want to be part of that too. I know Tess has a share in that with her mushroom growing. So that's kind of the at school for the community garden. So that's why we're focusing on a production garden rather than an allotment garden, because we also do have an allotment garden where anyone can buy a plot and just take home whatever they grow. But the idea of the garden that I've been speaking about is that it's a demonstration garden. It's to show you how much food you can produce in a spot the size that it is. So we have 4 by 12 beds, and we consistently produce every week and have enough to sell at the market every weekend. And you know, it fluctuates how much money we make, and we don't really try to compete. We sell everything for a dollar. So I mean, we're practically giving away food. We probably could make a lot more money, but the intention isn't really to profit. It's to get enough money just to maintain the garden. So the aspect of that, though, of the demonstration garden is to show people just how many different things can be connected to a garden, how many different potential, I don't know what the word necessarily would be, industries. I mean, for example, we have sage that we distilled and made essential oil, and now we're making soap from it. And so it's just to kind of show all these different things, make tinctures and tea. And, you know, so you can, you know, there's fruits, vegetables, teas, tinctures, essential oils, soap, lip balm, all these different little products and items that you can make from just a small garden if you're industrious. So that's the whole purpose of that space, is to show the potential that the earth provides. So
that's awesome. That's so great to hear. And you know, Mike just saw on the news the other day a whole thing about Detroit and the green movement that's going on there and the different community gardens. He was just telling me about it.
Right.
Super
crazy.
All right.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
You know, and it's funny because yesterday I interviewed somebody from Pittsburgh who also, or on Sunday, I think, and they're kind of in a similar boat. Like, well, they started when the steel mills, you know, closed up like 15, 20 years ago. First, they went with the healthcare industry, and they have like one of the biggest healthcare facilities in the world. I mean, they're internationally known for being one of the main sources of, you know, cutting edge healthcare. And now they're embracing the green movement as well to kind of like complement that. And so it doesn't really surprise me that much that Detroit is following in those footsteps. So kudos. Yeah, I mean, and kudos for being a part of it.
Thank you.
Wait, what'd you say? The rock salt?
No, the Rust Belt, it's, you know, this Midwest old industrial manufacturing center. You know, it's kind of fading away. We're not as relevant as we used to be, and you see the ruins of that all over, not just Detroit, Toledo, you know, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, all around the Great Lakes. And you know, a lot of people lost a lot of jobs, and there's a lot of empty land, and you know, it's what better to do on it than garden and farm and supply yourselves with healthy food. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great alternative to letting it just sit and waste. So
Yeah, and I think it also shows that there is, you know, a lot to be said for green jobs, and that we don't have to be stuck with the fossil fuel, you know, carbon, coal, that we're not going to lose jobs just because of that, and that if we are innovative and looking at other directions. And, you know, so I've been talking a lot about this thing called Aero in Montana, which is Alternative Energy Resource Organization. I just went to their annual meeting. But when the girl, their director, came on my show and kind of was telling me about it, she actually got involved with them because she's a lawyer, and she came out to work on a study to debunk the myth that green jobs don't produce, or that green energy and green alternatives don't produce, and sustainable agriculture don't produce jobs, and that we need to be stuck on the fossil fuel. And that's how she got involved with them to begin with. And now she's their executive director. And I think they are a local group in the state of Montana, but I think they are going to expand as people learn about them and as they continue their work. And and it sounds like you are doing great things in Detroit too. So I love to hear your passion and the things that you're talking about. And I, other listeners of my show also know I love the millennials. I think the millennials are just rocking it. They're so socially and environmentally conscious. I think they're going to be the greatest generation to to lead our future.
I think there's time for some change, you know. I mean, it's a lot of things. It's kind of funny. I think a lot of my generation, it's just a lot of common sense things. I don't think we need necessarily such radical changes, but just, you know, the things that you can do on a daily basis to make your life better. I mean, just grow a garden, and how much, how much does that help the planet and everybody if you just take a little bit of your food supply and take control over that? I mean, it's immense. I've seen statistics, but I don't know how necessarily true, but I have to imagine that, you know, shipping bananas from South America just isn't a sustainable model. And if you can grow, you can grow your food in your backyard, why do you need to ship it across the country or from another country? So, I mean, I think just simple things like that is a great place to start, if nothing else.
You know, I also had this other guest that actually from Jennifer Jill Hart, this guy, Bob Quinn, and he talked about all the fruit he grows on his farm in Montana. And just, you know, because you're talking about bananas and people are like, what am I going to eat if I can't eat a banana? But here he is producing enough fruit for his family and, you know, and growing it on his farm. And he just talked about all the different berries and the different fruit trees they can have. And we all know Eastern Montana has some tough weather. And if he can grow it there, you know, you need to find your local foods.
Right. I'm not saying everybody should quit eating bananas. If you like a banana, go ahead and get a banana. But maybe consider all that it has to go through, you know, to get to you is all I ask of people.
And I think there's a big problem with bananas being, they've been modified so much that what you're eating really isn't a banana too much. I mean, I'm not saying that either. I love my bananas, and they, you know, certainly have things in them.
I love bananas.
but also, you know, just there are options, and just to think about, you know, supplementing some of those options.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and
do we
I
need
know in Michigan, peaches are amazing, so.
Yeah. And my friend Marissa that I was telling you that did the thing this summer where she would teach people how to cook the food in their we did a Friday bonus episode on how to cook what came in your CSA. She was talking about her brother in Missoula having a peach tree, and he was gone on the fires, I think, or something, and she went over to his house to take care of, and his neighbor just had been picking the peaches while he was gone, and she couldn't believe how many peaches were growing just in his tree in Missoula.
Right.
Which is also another
peaches
cool
are
place.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I was surprised too. I saw my friend had a peach tree, and I couldn't believe it. It's not even a very large or old peach tree, and it was just churning them out. So, if you're a fruit addict,
yeah, I don't think we could have a fruit tree at my house. I think I'm still just a little too north. We're 4 hours north of Missoula. I would be surprised if we could have one here. But we grew cantaloupes and watermelons this year that we have never grown before because I gave a little thing about what I learned from sunflowers. And one of the big things I learned was, you know, variety is a huge difference. That's something I've also learned from this podcast this year, that there are there's a great big difference in the variety. Don't just, you know, you need to research out. I'm always like the last one. Mike's yelling at me. I need seeds. So I end up at either the hardware store or Home Depot or somewhere just buying the first seeds I see in front of me because I've waited right. so long. But this year I'm really going to plan more and start looking at some of the more organic seed companies. And of course, Robin Kelson yeah. down in Whitefish, who has the good seed company, is going to, I've bought a lot of seeds from her already this year. For next mm-hmm. year, but what a difference that can make in your growing season. So there right. might be some peaches out yeah, there, sure. a variety that will grow here that I just don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, you
about.
Might be able to find something. I think you could. I mean, it's pretty cold here. I know Montana's definitely got a colder, longer winter, but Detroit's not warm either.
I wanted to ask you about Detroit's climate was that at that conference we went to, this one lady, Dr. Laura Lingneck, who wrote a book about sustainable agriculture, resilient agriculture, and growing with the age of climate change. And the thing that she really pointed out to me, I hadn't been paying as much attention to, is that the place that's seen the most change in the United States is actually, and she was talking about precipitation and how rain, you know, affects all our gardens, is that the East Coast has had so much rain. So is that, and then you were talking at the beginning about how you started out with a rainy, like, have you seen that over the years? Have you kind of noticed, like, lately it's just been super wet and harder to grow a garden?
I feel, you know, this is something I was saying to my friend, is that we need to take better notes on the weather, mm-hmm. Just to compare
documentation
each year
sure.
what we grow.
Yeah. I'm a data junkie.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It's my science training. But yeah, I feel like the beginning of the summers are colder and wetter each progressing year. And mm-hmm. I could probably look that up and figure out if that's true, but I've never had the difficulty. Like, I mean, I grow tomatoes every year, so I'm pretty used to knowing how they do. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was really just cold, wet, long spring. And most people's tomatoes and pepper, a lot of people ended up having to take them. A lot of people died or were just so bad they ended up taking them out and putting in new transplants because it was just not ideal for nobody's tomatoes and peppers did excellent. At least they're definitely a stunted depending on if you plant it early.
Okay.
Lesson for next year is in the East Coast, at least if you're in my zone, definitely wait to plant tomatoes. Tomatoes are one that, you know, you should be patient with for sure. Tomatoes and peppers, I think. So lesson learned this year. Cause I told myself too, I told everyone at the garden, I don't want to grow a lot of tomatoes cause they're relatively intensive. To grow, and we ended up with like 24 tomato plants. And I'm like, how did this happen? Because we get free plants. My initial design was to only grow 4 tomato plants and just try to really focus on growing them large and well. Instead, we ended up with a whole 4x12 bed filled with tomatoes, and it was a constant struggle to keep them healthy and upright. So. Yeah. Tomatoes are a good barometer for garden success, in my opinion. So.
That's a good point. That's a really good point to use that as a
Everybody
barometer.
Everybody grows them. Everybody grows tomatoes, so you can really compare notes with people, you know. And from year to year, you can track how they do. So I think it's a good thing to have. I wouldn't recommend growing a whole bunch of tomatoes unless you're really up for the challenge because, like I said, they are intensive, mm-hmm. definitely. So if you don't already know that, like cherry tomatoes are a lot easier than your larger varieties. So, but.
And they get ripe quicker and they're just fun. Like, you know, you can go down to the garden and all of a sudden, and they're always ready sooner or not always, but, you know, once they come on, then. You know, you grab a handful while you're down there. They don't need any processing.
I gave some to my neighbor. She's a little girl. She wanted to grow some plants. So I gave her a tomato and a little bit of basil and some verbena. Mm-hmm. And her tomatoes killed my tomatoes. She had She had bags and bags filled with tomatoes, and she didn't, and she's a little girl. She did amazing with it. And so, I mean, yeah, cherry tomatoes, smaller variety tomatoes, I think are, you know, anybody can grow that. The larger ones definitely take, you got to actually spend time with the plant on a regular basis and make sure that it's growing correctly.
Okay, do you want to give us some, like, concrete tips on, like, what kind of things that you can do to make your tomato plant grow strong? Like, you have to tie it up, right, or something?
Well,
what other things are you looking for?
First off, wait till it's warm. Do not rush to plant your tomatoes. I think that's the number one mistake. Mm-hmm. If you can start a seed indoors, do that. Don't start from seed unless you have a really long season, because it's not going to work. But yeah, go from transplant. Ideally, you know, start it yourself so you can kind of acclimate it and harden it off correctly, you know, in your little microclimate. And then I would say you wait to stake it until it begins to show signs of tipping. And then there's so many different ways you can do this. You can just simply, you know, bamboo stakes. I don't really like tomato cages. I find tomato cages actually cut off the circulation of the plant because the tomatoes get so heavy that the metal cage seems to kind of choke the plant, and you can see signs of damage. One thing I like is nylon net. If you go into a garden nursery, they'll often sell, like a volleyball net kind of, and what you do is you kind of you can do a couple different things. You can take a net and cut it down the center, not all the way through, so maybe 3/4 of the way to the other side, so that basically you're just able to open the net and then zip tie it back up around the base of the tomato plant.
Oh, cool.
And then you can I don't know if you know about topping plants, but plants have what are called apical meristems. So the tip of any shoot has what's called a meristem. And if you prune that off, you will get two shoots from there. So where there is one, you will get two. So you'll increase kind of the surface area of your plant. And you can, if you spend time with it, if you don't top your plant, if you don't prune the meristem, you'll get just one long shoot that'll branch out. Once it starts to fruit, it'll start to produce more branches. But if you pinch that off earlier or cut it off with some scissors, just the very tip, you'll get two shoots there. If you do each of those, you'll get four shoots and so on. But you can spread that out over a net, so you can really kind of lay the plant open on a net and really increase the surface area and the amount of light that hits the plant. And with less plants, you can grow a lot more tomatoes that way. So,
wow.
So that's one cool way I like to do it. Also, nurseries, this is more production style. There's there's determinate and indeterminate varieties of tomatoes. And if you grow indeterminate variety, you know, you continue to sucker them or, you know, take off the pre-flowers before they turn into a fruit at the bottom of the plant. And they'll keep just growing vertically. And once a tomato sets, you don't touch it then. But before you start to see tomato setting, you kind of sucker off from the bottom. And there's plant collars. They're like these little plastic rings. You don't need to use that. You can just use string. But you can tie up a tall pole, and you can just kind of tie the plant up. You can kind of suspend it from the top. You can, and then keep moving the rope or string or plant collar upwards as it grows vertically.
Oh.
And you're basically growing it like, kind of imagine if you just grew, some beans and you only, and you didn't grow it on a trellis. You just had one string that you tied to the tip of the plant, and then it would grow up from that, and then you continually tie it upwards. So you're kind of suspending your tomato plant a little bit. So it's kind of like the opposite of staking it. It's more of suspension. So just that's more for indeterminate varieties. So that would be useful because those can grow very tall. Those can grow, I think I've seen like 8 feet tall tomato plants.
Wow.
Like, doing it that way. So there's some interesting ways to grow tomatoes. You can look that up. Just, you know, indeterminate varieties, if people don't already know, they're good if you're really wanting to grow a lot of tomatoes. But, yeah, I like nylon nets instead of tomato cages, and you can be crafty on how you hold the net up. We just put in 4 posts around the bed and kind of strung a net. You can put the net down before you put the plant in, and then you can guide the plant to go up through the trellis or the net.
So, oh, excellent.
So, yeah, those are some, I think, and they're just kind of neat, different ways to grow, so.
Wow, like lots of great cages. Information there. okay, I wanted to ask you a question about... So then, if indeterminates produce a lot, what's their like benefit to growing them? So do they have a better taste or something, or flavor, or size, or consistency?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's highly subjective, I would mm-hmm. say. Indeterminate varieties are definitely grown for, like, in a greenhouse. Those are grown for your yield. So I don't know how many home gardeners necessarily want to do it unless you're really just trying to show off to your neighbor, or maybe if you do sell at a market or something. I'm not like terribly well versed on the intricacies of tomato varieties.
Sure.
But your determinant varieties are going to be more of your different bread. Kind of unique, you know, like what's the Austrian, I know there's like the Austrian, I don't want to start listing tomato
that's
varieties.
That's right. Yeah.
That
no, that's fine.
That. But your indeterminate is basically going to be a larger tomato typically, as far as I know. And, it'll just produce more tomatoes throughout the course of the season. If you follow the steps, kind of how I mentioned, mm-hmm. you will get a larger yield with that. That's basically the only difference. I mean, determinant varieties, just they have a determined height. Once they start to fruit, they don't grow taller.
Okay.
The indeterminate will continue to grow vertically.
Okay.
So, I mean, they'll grow indeterminately, almost indefinitely. So as long as provide the space for it to grow, it'll grow quite large. So.
Oh, that's a great way to explain that. I've heard people talk about that, but nobody's really explained that that's the kind of difference. Determined, have a certain height that they're going to get to and a certain shape and whatnot.
It's determined. Cool. Yeah.
I was thinking it's kind of like a basil plant. When you pinch off a basil plant, is that the way it is? It goes? Is that when you're saying you kind of pinch it off on top?
Are you saying like when it's flowering, or are you saying just to get more shoots to grow?
Yeah, like when my basil plant first starts growing, they'll get like 2 leaves, and if I pinch those 2 leaves, 2 more will grow in a different direction. Then it'll become more of a bushier plant than if it just grows
straight
up.
Right.
Sounds
yeah,
like,
exactly.
kind of like that.
It'll be bushier. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I didn't realize that worked with tomatoes.
Yeah, I think it's not as pronounced with tomatoes, but but yeah, it happens. Mm-hmm. You can't really, it doesn't, because tomato shoots don't grow the same way that basil grows, but it whenever you pinch the top of any plant, the hormone auxin starts to flow, because the hormone auxin is always flowing vertically up and down, and it inhibits lateral growth or side growth. So anytime that you disconnect that top shoot, it stops inhibiting lateral growth. So yeah, I don't know.
Cool.
I don't know how far I should go into that. So.
Let's move on, because we're actually at 45 minutes already.
Okay.
And we're only on like question 2. So how about something you're excited to try different or new next year? Is there something you're excited about?
I mean, not necessarily like in terms of plants, but maybe in the style of growing them. I like to utilize vertical space because we have such, you know, we're trying to be productive in a small space. So Probably just growing our zucchini or different melons, cucumbers more vertically, and trying to utilize, grow like maybe greens underneath kind of vertical spaces. And one thing I'm wanting to try is to grow some passion flower kind of. I grew passion flower this year, but to grow it kind of over to make I don't know what the word is, just like an overhang, to tie some string essentially and try to grow it and provide a shaded area in the center of the garden using just plants. So kind of like a plant roof. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I like morning glories and passion flower to kind of grow vertically and fill in spaces and just be kind of ornamental. So just to provide lots of growth in the garden and spaces that are open for that. So I'm excited to grow more vertical sort of ornamental plants for next year.
Excellent. Do you want to tell us about something that didn't work so well this year?
It was okay. They produced well, but my tomatoes, I was disappointed in just how many we had, and it was a struggle to grow so many. So that's probably my one, I would say, disappointment was just the number of plants. I'm a perfectionist. Like, it kind of drove me insane to have so many tomato plants to be taken care of all the time. So that's why I brought that up earlier. Don't get overzealous on growing any one thing in the garden, I would say.
That's important advice. That's super important advice.
Right.
So then
it is, trust me.
Tomatoes, what you would say is something you find easy to grow and generally successful every time, or
no?
What'd you want to say for
that? You gotta find the right variety that suits your growing style and your environment, that's it pretty much. Just be conscientious of the variety. Don't grow too many tomato plants. I mean, depending on the size of your garden, I don't know how big every listener's garden is, but I know tomatoes are always a top, everybody talks about growing tomatoes in the garden. I would say if you're not experienced growing tomatoes, don't start by growing a lot of tomatoes. Grow just a couple plants and then see how they do. Grow two different varieties or grow a couple different varieties before you decide. But then I would say kind of stick with one that you like, because then you can, you can save your own seeds and you can get a tomato plant that you really like that's bred for your very specific garden, your soil. True, grow yourself an heirloom strain.
Absolutely. I went to a seed saving kind of workshop class this summer, and they taught us how to save tomato seeds, and it was super easy. So, and I'm hopefully going to have a guest on soon that's going to talk about saving seeds, this guy, Bill McDormand. We've been saving a lot of seeds this year. As a matter of fact, Mike just saved some of those cantaloupe and watermelon seeds from last year yesterday. He was just kind of washing them off and putting them in packets and drying them and stuff in the little strainer. Right. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
I guess I don't want to talk about this too much, but I would probably just go back to tomatoes. I would say grow tomatoes, but don't get overzealous about it. But other than that, I mean, I guess be careful with growing melons and, cucumbers, zucchini, powdery. We're definitely susceptible to powdery mildew around here. Pretty much every garden I walked into had powdery mildew on their melon, on the leaves. So, just be aware if you're growing a lot of that. Because I know they're really easy to grow, and you get, you get nice large melons or whatever you're growing, zucchini, squash. But they're powdery mildew, you're close to the ground. It's really moist down there. So if you're going to grow them, try to maybe lift them off the ground somehow, even a trellis or some way to just get them lifted off the dirt at least. Don't grow on the dirt, because I think that increases the susceptibility to powdery mildew and different types of molds. and rot. So
I'm curious, like, do you think that one of the reasons there is so much powdery mildew is because of all the rain and moisture you guys are getting on the eastern side?
Oh, yeah.
There's a link there.
It's humid.
Because I've heard a lot of people talk about that this year.
Yeah, we have humid summers in general. So, I mean, I think lift your stuff off the ground if you can. Like, I talked about the nylon net, and you just build a couple, like, posts that are, like, a foot tall and drape your plant over, you know, spread the net out real taut and try to train your plant up a net, and they'll grow on that right off the, you know, and they'll grow off the ground, and you won't have as many problems. But
you are the man with the solutions. I love that. Because that's been a big question a lot of people have talked about and listeners have asked me, and that's a great solution to put nets under them.
Right. It's easy. And you don't have to use a net. You can use, if you have a metal cage, but then beware of rust. I mean, make sure it's galvanized or coated somehow. But, you know, obviously be aware of what's in your garden. What's, you know, is it coated with a chemical that's going to degrade or something? Mm-hmm. You know, ask that before you buy or do anything. Mm-hmm. But, if you spray, you can spray your leaves with, I know, you know, baking soda, you just got to get your pH high. Powdery mildew does not like a high alkalinity surface. It will not grow on a high alkaline surface. So if you, I think like a pH of 10 is safe for plants. So if you just mix in like baking soda and milk and spray your plant leaves before powdery mildew sets in, before you any signs of it, you kind of do it preventatively, that will stop powdery mildew from occurring in the first place. So.
Wow. Excellent. Okay, Adam, do you have an activity that's like your least favorite activity to do in the garden? You got to force yourself to get out there.
Weeding.
Okay.
When you start to grow a large amount of plants, weeds are a huge pain. I'm experimenting more with weed barriers, but those have drawbacks too. It's harder to start from seed if you like to just kind of scatter seeds or lettuce or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a weed barrier doesn't work then, because weed barrier is like a cloth kind of breathable material. Mm-hmm. And you dig out your soil a little bit, like maybe 3 inches, put the weed barrier, you put the weed barrier right above where you would, the top of where the base of your plant or the root ball would be. So it's just really nice, because, and then you cover it back up with soil and it's breathable and with water through, but it doesn't let weeds grow up. So it's pretty nice. So weeding, I hate. It's not bad in your own home little garden, depending on the size of your garden, but. Mm-hmm. If you have a large garden, maybe look into some weed barrier.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be my advice. So.
And then I always tell listeners, like, because we lived a long time with very limited water. So if you really aim your water specifically right at the roots of your plants instead of just, but it's hard, it's much harder to do that when you're watering a bigger space. And then it's also like, it's the flip side. How long are you going to stand there with the hose in your hand? So, you know,
true.
Everything's got its thing.
You
got to
weigh all those things out.
For us, that's always kept our weeds down a lot. But I know as Mike grew, like, kind of a mini farm this year, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I thought, oh my goodness, how are we ever going to deal with all the weeds? But I think just because we're just so much drier. And we had the opposite of you. We had an extremely dry year.
Yeah, we had a really wet.
Constantly dry.
We have a battle of the weeds this year.
Yeah. So. Oh, all right. Well, on a positive note, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Probably eat. Harvest and eat.
A true
ripe,
man.
I mean, what's better than to pick up some really fresh, you know, vegetables or seeds, fruits, and put it right in your mouth. So, some fresh strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
Delicious. That's gotta be my favorite thing. But I mean, I just like working in the garden in general.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime it's hot and I sweat. I like I like exercise, so.
Uh-huh. Okay. And a couple of my guests, my friend Joe out in Maine, the custodian, and then Kelly Ware, both talked about gardening CrossFit and gardening, getting in shape from gardening.
Right, that's what we're going to do. You know, like, toss bags of dirt and have competition.
Hey, that's a great idea. The gardener's competition. Who's the fittest gardener? Oh, I like that, Adam.
Gardener's CrossFit games.
Yeah. Because we've been thinking about having some kind of like a rodeo, but we could throw in some gardener's CrossFit games. Excellent competition.
Wheelbarrows, dirt, piles of soil. Can turn the composter a few times. I don't know. Could think of some ideas.
Cool. Oh, all right. Heads are spinning. How about the best gardening advice you ever received?
Just be patient.
That's a good one.
That's what my grandpa would tell me. I mean, plants don't grow, you know. You don't typically see a lot of change overnight. I know people are really, like overwatering, you know, is probably, it's way better to underwater than overwater in my experience.
Yep.
So, like, you know, anything you're doing in the garden, maybe just wait a day before you do it if you're uncertain. So, just be patient with gardening.
Mm-hmm. And then I have to say, there is like this short little window in the middle of summer when the sun comes out hot and it seems like the plants grow like 3 inches overnight. But
right.
It does take a long time to get there.
Right. You got to be patient, though, for that and provide, you know, try to make that, provide that environment so that when the window is right, the plants can just kind of take off on their own. Don't try to force that to happen.
Good one. Excellent.
Because it won't.
How about, what's your favorite tool? Like, if you had to move and couldn't live without a tool, what would it be?
Probably I guess a shovel. Shovel's pretty useful in the garden. Shovel or, yeah, I'd say a shovel.
Or right, well, go ahead shovel. And give us two. What would be your second?
I mean, then probably a rake, you know, if you got a lot of garden, you can turn soil over and then rake out weeds, and two pretty common activities that I do. So I'd say those are crucial to my garden wellness. So
My first reaction to that question was a shovel, and then I changed it to the wheelbarrow. I was like, I could not live without a wheelbarrow.
Yeah,
and to me, I was like, I could make a shovel out of cardboard or buy. It wouldn't be easy. I'm sure there's things that I would really want to shovel for, but I don't know. We had a wheelbarrow with a flat tire for a season, and it just drove me crazy.
Right. Yeah. When you say that, I don't know. That's a tough question. I don't know about that one.
No, a shovel's pretty essential, for sure. I couldn't live without a shovel, I'm sure, either. How about for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Like, already I'm inundated with peppers, and, like, I had this question at the beginning, and then I kind of took it away, and now I'm putting it right back, because I'm inundated with eggplants and peppers, and we had cucumbers for a while.
Right.
Granted, Mike grew right. a big garden this year, but still, like, I thought about taking him to the food pantry the other day, and then I was like, wait, who's really going to cook eggplants? You know, the peppers they might have, but for me to take a trip
right.
just to town just to do that, I ended up not going and just figuring, I was like, you know what, I'll just make eggplant parmesan for my friends and give them to them frozen, which I started that project and still haven't finished it. But, you know, got any suggestions for that kind of thing?
I mean, as far as harvesting on time, that is just, you gotta eat it. You gotta pick it and eat it and just see how it tastes. Don't use visuals so much as your mouth, I would say, is a better indicator than how it looks. But in terms of preservation, pressure cooker, I mean, that's, I don't do so much canning because I end up just giving a lot of my stuff away to my neighbors and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't really can very much, but my friend is really big into canning, and I mean, he has really good stuff that tastes really good, and fermented foods too, but I'm not huge into that myself, just more of the taste for me, but Yeah, I don't know. I think just canning. If you have a big harvest and you don't think people are going to eat it, I think a lot of people have a pressure cooker. The info is out there on canning stuff. It's not too difficult. I know pickling lime, a lot of people use to kind of pickle different things. So if you got a lot of cucumbers or something, I know a lot of people end up with a ton of cucumbers that they don't eat. So I throw that out there.
I have a friend who also makes a delicious cucumber water. She has a blog called Simply Josephine. If you ever want some recipes on, or a good recipe for a really good water, she puts like berries and cucumbers and stuff for a refreshing drink.
Look into that. I always have more cucumbers than I need. So.
And then my husband cans a lot of pickles. But also I had a woman on from the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener, Holly, who's a canning expert. She has a lot of YouTube videos on canning. And then I talk a lot about this woman, Teresa Lowe, who has a podcast called Living Homegrown. And she's the PBS canning expert and even has a course on how to can things. But awesome, I don't know. Yeah. Mike cans like our carrots and our green beans and the pickles. And he's just about to do pickled beets. But I don't know about canning eggplant. I'll have to. And then Megan Kane talks about freezing peppers, so I might freeze some of my peppers this year, just cutting them up and freezing them. I guess I didn't realize you could do that, just freeze peppers. That's a tough question
I do
for
have,
a lot of people.
My favorite thing to eat out of, like, I'd love to just get fresh tomatoes. My mom's 100% Italian, and my family is extremely Italian, so I love good cheese and, like, little crustini crackers, good olive oil and tomatoes. I love brie cheese, so I love to just take some fresh tomatoes, brie, and crackers, and eat.
Cool.
Delicious.
I like that. How about a favorite internet resource?
Favorite internet resource? That's really tough. I do like Share the Seeds.
Share the Seeds?
Oh, cool.
Okay.
So, it's a lot of, like, it's not so much about necessarily your typical vegetable varieties, but just all kinds of like exotic plants and stuff. People will share seeds with you. So I think that's just a pretty cool idea.
I like that.
And you get like karma points if you share more seeds yourself. And so people give away all kinds of seeds and plants even. So there's a lot of tropical species and just a lot of strange plants and cacti and stuff, not so terribly useful for your vegetable or fruit garden. So.
That's okay, because some people, you know, one of my most listened to episodes was a woman who talked about growing houseplants. So, you know, people have all different things, and then
growing inside. So.
My brother's episode where they don't grow any vegetables, but he just talked about he's on Long Island living in the suburbs and they're, you know, the native plants they put in their yard and herbs that they grow. And then he talked a lot about his compost pile. So we listeners, you know, have all sorts of things they like to hear about. I think that's kind of what they like about my show is my diversity of guests.
Well, it's cool.
How about, do you have a favorite book or magazine or blog or anything that you would recommend?
I really like, I guess because I come from a biology background, I really like James Lovelock. He's kind of the, what's the word? He created the Gaia theory, which is like a scientific theory that, sees that the Earth is one living organism. And he's a real biologist, works for NASA, and he's an atmospheric scientist, and it's basically planetary physiology. So how to like look at planets and see them as living, self-regulating, just self-regulating organisms, essentially. Mm-hmm. That the whole thing is one organism. It's not a disconnected series of parts. One entity, and I think seeing a scientist with real peer-reviewed research that's rigorous, I feel like people, you know, there's something to it, and it's tough for us to see because we're so, you know, we're so small in terms of the size relative to the Earth, but think it's really important to realize that the whole planet is alive. And what we do, what each and every one of us does, affects the whole. So we should be aware, if nothing else, that that's going on. And his books are Gaia Theory. Then he has one. It's like a new look at life on Earth. He has tons of books, and they're pretty easy to understand. There's some different levels of it. So some are simpler, some are more complex, geared towards people with science background. But it's pretty easy to get into this stuff, and I think it's actually really entertaining because he does work for NASA, and in light of finding water on Mars, this is all pretty interesting stuff. So to me, at least.
Cool.
So yeah, James Lovelock.
All right.
One of my favorite authors.
I'll link that up in the show notes. Excellent. Nobody's recommended him, and he sounds exciting. So do you have any, since you're in charge of the community garden and going to the farmer's market, do you have any suggestions or like advice for listeners who want to get started either selling their produce at a farmer's market or creating a community garden or anything like that?
Well, in terms of selling at the market, definitely go check out the competition. see what's there already. And are you going to be able to compete? Do you want to compete necessarily? Because, you know, in a farmer's market, do you really want to shove out the farmer? You know, do you really want to compete with that? So maybe look at it as more, how can I create a niche rather than dominate the competition? So, you know, I think the farmer's market, try to generally create a friendlier atmosphere in terms of business competition rather than an adversarial one. I think just that attitude alone will carry you pretty far. But in terms of creating a community garden, it's really about sustained efforts. So if you have a good group of people to do it, that's really the most important part. If you're just trying to start it out of scratch, start small. Don't start a farm, you know, start a few beds and just go from there and just grow the garden and grow the community around it. So I think just baby steps. There's no, like I said, I think patience has been the number one thing I've been being schooled on in my experience with gardening. So
cool. Okay, ready for my final question? It's a doozy.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, Adam, is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Well, I would say, I think climate change is definitely the most relevant issue that people, I believe that your listeners are probably not in denial, but it's still hard to really come to terms with it because it changes so slowly and it's hard to see that on a seasonal basis. But I really think that the solution for the problems in our world, I mean, just being pollution and just unnecessary waste, I really believe that just going outside and planting a garden, whether you can do that in your backyard or join a community garden, just surround yourself with like-minded people and just go and grow. If you can grow yourself even a very small amount of food, if you can create one meal for yourself a day or source your food locally, you're taking tremendous stress off the environment. I mean, how many gallons of gasoline get burned for a banana to come from South America to Detroit, you know? So I don't want people to feel guilty, but it's just, cause that won't get anybody anywhere. But I think, you know, you just need to think rationally about where you're sourcing your food from. Cause that's what sustains us. You know, you are what you eat, they say. So, you know, I encourage people just to go and start a garden or be involved in gardening. I think that's probably one of the best, the most simple solution that everyone can do. So,
You know what I was going to ask you, sorry, at the very beginning was like, how come you're growing your tomatoes in pots? Because they're easy to rotate or because that's the space you have? Or like, what made you make that decision? Because I, the one thing I think about growing things in pot is that pots is that they take more, you have to water them more. And for us, I guess maybe because we had a water shortage, that's like a bigger challenge for me. So is there a reason why you said you grew your pots at your tomato plants at home in big pots?
I get bigger yields growing in pots because they do dry out faster. Mm-hmm. I can water them more. I can feed them more, and they grow more vigorously. Because I, instead of kind of when it rains, you know, you don't, and the ground gets soaked, you don't get to really control that. You don't. So, but I can control the inputs into a pot more simply than I can into my garden bed. So,
okay,
when I'm growing, just curious, when I'm growing for yield. It's like I said, it's kind of competition to grow tomatoes around here.
In your family, too.
So that's just how I do it. And it's really easy to make sure that it grows uniformly because I'm able to rotate it and move it wherever the sun is. And tomatoes love sun. And I don't, my backyard, I couldn't, if I left it in the same spot, if there's nowhere that all year long, or all season long, it would get the sun that it needs to get large as I would like. So,
I think that's awesome. Those are some great tips for people who maybe haven't been as successful before, or somebody who wants to try it. Because there are definitely some benefits to growing things in a pot.
It's a good way to learn, if nothing else. Right. How to grow. It forces you to kind of pay attention to that single plant in that pot, or however many plants, but that little unit. You know, you definitely, right. It's easier to look at that versus a whole garden. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's not as intimidating for sure. Right. How about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden? As if what you have said all day hasn't been enough, but, you know, just a little goodbye tip.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have a inspirational quote or anything. I mean, my inspiration just comes from being in nature. So that's my message is just go outside, be around what is growing.
So, okay.
How many living things are around you? That's the more living things around you, the better quality of life, in my opinion. So.
Oh, that's perfect. If listeners wanted to connect with you, is there a way, or should they just, they can put a thing in the show notes, or do you have any kind of like public thing? If you don't, that's fine.
Yeah, I have my organization email is dig.gardenwayne@gmail.com. And if anybody wants to reach me for anything, they can contact me there. And, I'll get back to you.
So. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing everything with us today. And
yeah, no
listeners
problem.
Learned
it's
a
exciting.
Ton.
Yeah. I really support, you know, things like this. This is the best thing I think that people can get involved in. So garden.
Thanks, Adam.
Yep. No problem.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.